Thank you so much, and what a pleasure it is for me to be speaking at this sort of an event where you have people from a wide variety of backgrounds, but they have one thing in common. They spend a lot of time looking at the big picture, focusing on the forest instead of the trees. And so it's nice to be at an event that is so forest-oriented. I would like to tell a narrative about what caused the crisis of 2008. And I bring to my story a lawyer's perspective. Please don't fall asleep quite yet. It will get more exciting. Because it turns out that capitalism, I would argue, is not an economic concept. Capitalism is fundamentally a legal concept. It's a description of a system of laws, in particular, at a minimum, private property and enforced contractual exchange. A free market without law is essentially Hobbes's world, where the strong and the fast take whatever they want from the weak and the slow. Capitalism is a legal system. And the kind of capitalism we've had for the last 15 years involves a legal system that Adam Smith would not have recognized and certainly would not have named as capitalist. This is another way of saying that my working hypothesis is that the primary cause of the 2008 crisis was not a change in markets or some sort of innovation. It was actually a pretty much unnoticed but revolutionary change in the law. Well, what's the law I'm talking about? It's essentially the law of gambling, which dates back at least to the Babylonian period. So we have a good 3,000 years. What the Romans did with gambling is particularly interesting, but not too dissimilar with what we've done with it in other countries at other times. But the reason why I'm talking about the gambling laws is because that is what derivatives are. Derivatives are bets. I do not mean that to be a metaphor or a figure of speech. Derivatives are literally bets. They are agreements between two parties that, depending on what happens in the future, one party will pay the other a sum of money. And just as you can bet on the outcome of a horse race without owning a horse, you can use derivatives, particularly financial derivatives, to bet on the fates of market phenomena like interest rates, credit ratings, inflation rates, without having to own a deposit of money that brings an interest, or the bond whose credit is being rated, or an asset whose value would change with inflation rates. Derivatives are merely bets, nothing more or nothing less. Now, some of them are quite complicated bets, and maybe that's why some people talk about derivatives as being innovations, to which I will simply say the trifecta is an innovation. I don't think the Romans used trifecta betting systems when they were looking at the chariot races, but that doesn't change the reality that derivatives today are bets, just as Babylonian bottomry contracts, as they were called, were bets on the success or failure of trading caravans. Now, when I say derivatives are bets, it is not unusual. I love this audience, by the way. I feel safe with you, because when I say derivatives are bets in front of some audiences, you see a visible tightening in the room. And the reason is because the idea of betting has many negative connotations, and no one likes to be told that what they do for a living and what they do to justify their existence is the equivalent of gambling. But it's important to remember that you don't have to use bets for gambling. They have other very valuable uses. In particular, you can use a bet to offset a risk that you're already exposed to. So if I own a house in California and I'm worried about wildfires, I might make a bet with an insurance company that my house will burn down. We call that insurance. Insurance is fundamentally a wagering market. And in an ideal world, if all bets were used only for insurance, you would, in fact, have this wonderful such synthesis where you not only will get people who have less risk, you might even have more equal distribution of wealth. The problem arises from the fact that bets can be used for things other than hedging. They can be used for something that goes roughly by the name of speculation, which means trying to make a profit by predicting future events better than other people can. Just as I might try to profit predicting the outcome of a horse race, I might try to profit from predicting where interest rates are going or what the rating on a particular corporation's bonds is going to be. When bets are used for speculative purposes, they can cause economic problems. And it's important here to go back to Adam Smith. One of the interesting linguistic difficulties that I am seeing out there when you try and talk about the strengths and weaknesses of capitalism is there is a tendency, and it's fairly modern, it's not traditional, to assume that anything you do that makes money must be productive. Adam Smith knew better. He knew better in The Wealth of Nations. You don't even have to read The Moral Sentiments. In The Wealth of Nations, he talks about how there are some ways of making money and some ways of spending money that are more productive than others. And this is where law comes in. The law for thousands of years has distinguished between ways of making money that are predictive, that are productive and that are subsidized by the law, ways of making money that are destructive and that are penalized by the law, and ways of making money that are neither productive nor destructive, and the law, at least in some places and times, including the United States up until 2000, doesn't get involved. So let me give you some examples. Suppose I have a gun and I put it to Bob's head and I say, pay me $1,000 or I'm going to kill you. Bob writes me a check for $1,000. Now that is a voluntary transaction, right? What's the difference between that and Adam Smith's butcher and baker? We're both better off. Well, the problem is, I'm getting Bob to engage in a voluntary transaction with me by threatening to hurt him. And that creates incentives for people to invest in learning how to hurt other people. So they will go around trying to destroy other people's wealth in order to be bribed not to destroy it. That shrinks the pie. On the other hand, maybe I'm a skilled artist. I can be as fantastic as I want here, right? Maybe I'm a skilled artist and I do a wonderful painting and Bob really likes it and he says, I'll pay you $1,000 for that painting. Now that's a contract that Adam Smith and the law would both approve of, whereas making money by threatening to kill people is illegal and penalized by law. The law subsidizes most voluntary exchanges between people who are being productive and producing something that is valued by the other person. There is this interesting middle area, though, where you get money from someone else by doing something that doesn't create value and doesn't necessarily directly destroy it, but just takes money from one person's pocket and puts it into the other. And that would be Bob and I looking at each other, and I say, you know, I think interest rates are going to stay stable. And he says, I think interest rates are going to go up. And we bet on interest rates with what's called an interest rate swap. And at the moment we make that bet, we both think we're going to make money. But inescapable logic tells us one of us is wrong. This is a mistaken contract. And at the end of the day, all it does is transfer wealth. It is a gambling contract. Well, the law has known this for thousands of years and has treated gambling contracts by treating them not as against the law, not as something to be punished, nor as legitimate exchange to be and judges and lawyers who will help you enforce the contract, but simply as something that the law had no interest in. Gaming contracts traditionally were legally unenforceable. This was true for Roman games of dice, although during the two-week festival of Saturnalia, I think they were legally enforceable, but the rest of the time, the other 50 weeks, gambling contracts were unenforceable. And it was true for gambling on market phenomena for pretty much all of recorded history as far as I know. In jurisdictions where occasionally a new form of gambling crops up, people do not recognize it as gambling, and it's treated as a legally enforceable transaction until some disaster occurs, at which point people finally recognize it for what it is, and it is treated as gambling. Which is, by the way we treated derivatives in the United States for as long as there has been a United States. Derivatives are not innovations. In the 19th century, they were called difference contracts, and they were essentially contracts between two people in which instead of buying or selling a good, they would just bet each other what would happen to the market price of the good, and they would settle up when the time came to measure the difference between the gambling price and the actual market price. That's why they were called difference contracts. And the view of the law was you could enter difference contracts or derivatives all you wanted, but you could not enforce them in the courts. They were not worthy of public subsidy, because a free market is really an oxymoron. If we're talking about anything other than Hobbes's world, a free market is really a market where there are laws and the state and the public. American law would not subsidize gaming contracts or difference contracts, just as in Adam Smith's day, British law would not subsidize these contracts by enforcing them. And the reason was very specific. I'm going to do it on time. Well, which was that gambling, whatever its moral qualities, produced economic problems. It shrank the pie through several different mechanisms. And if you read 19th century contract cases, it's really just amazing. There's nothing new under the sun. The judges discussing difference contracts in the 19th century could have been discussing derivatives markets today. So, for example, one of the problems with enforcing gambling contracts or difference contracts was that it, quote, discourages the disposition to engage in steady labor. In other words, we take valuable human capital and we waste it by having people spend their time trying to pick each other's pockets. And you have heard this criticism, I'm sure, of the rise of Wall Street and the financialization of the economy. Some of our best mathematical and scientific minds were drawn into what was essentially a zero-sum game and wasted. Another argument, however, against gambling or difference contracts that I found fascinating was the recognition that gambling, far from reducing risk the way hedging does, increases risk. And when you think about it, that's the very nature of gambling. When you sit down to the poker table with $100 in your wallet, you have a certainty of $100. The minute you enter the game, you now have a probability. You may have $10 when you leave, you may have $200, you may have $400. But what you've taken is a certainty and you've translated it into a variable probability. In other words, you have created risk where there was none before. So if you look at the history of derivatives, well, of course, that requires you knowing there is a history, but if you know there's a history of derivatives and you look at it, you would be perfectly aware that a change in the legal rules that made derivatives used for speculation legally enforceable, in effect subsidizing them, was going to create a much larger derivatives market. And a much larger derivatives market that contained a lot of speculation posed the risk of adding risk to the economic system instead of decreasing it. And that is exactly what we did in the United States in the mid-1980s through 1990s to 2000. I may be the only person in the room. If someone else recognizes these legal rules, let me know. I will be deeply impressed, and I'll know there's at least one other lawyer here. But in 1992, oh, by the way, what happened to the common law against difference contracts? We codified it into what was called the Grain Futures Act of 1926, I think it was, which eventually became the Commodities Exchange Act of 1936. The interesting thing about commodities law is that it actually has nothing to do with commodities. No real pork bellies or red wheat number two ever changes hands. Commodities law is really gambling law, derivatives law. So we codified it, and then we started getting rid of it as part of the wave of deregulation that was favored in the 1980s and 90s. It started with the Commodities Futures Trading Commission creating an exemption for what's called over-the-counter derivative trading. Let me back up just a little bit. The fact that trading in derivatives contracts was not an enforceable contract didn't stop people from gambling, as you might imagine. What it did was it motivated them to create private gambling clubs, just as there were private gambling clubs in Roman days. In the 19th century, you know what we called our private gambling clubs? The commodities exchanges. And they are still in existence today, the Chicago Board of Trade, the Chicago Mercantile. And the neat thing about a private gambling club is the only people who are allowed to gamble are people who can pay off their bets, because the bets are guaranteed by the gambling club, which has a very keen interest in making sure that gamblers don't get over their heads. So we had this wonderful system where people gambled as much as they wanted on the commodities exchanges, but it didn't cause any problems for the rest of us or the rest of the economy, because gambling was not subsidized with public money. By the way, you could enter a difference contract off of an exchange and get it legally enforced, but you had to prove that at least one of the parties was truly hedging, that you had an insurable interest or an indemnity interest. So what really happened was gambling law divided into two parts, commodities law and insurance law. So somehow this system worked so well that, as far as I can tell, the vast majority of people literally forgot about it until the 1980s, at which point someone on Wall Street thought, let's start making interest rate swaps, essentially bets on interest rates. And whoever came up with this idea didn't realize at first that these were so-called illegal off-exchange futures under the Commodities Exchange Act, or unenforceable difference contracts under the common law. They thought they were enforceable, and a large market developed. And by the time a couple of smart lawyers pointed out that maybe these things weren't enforceable, the industry had enough political power, it was able to go to the CFTC and get an exemption from both the Commodities Exchange Act and the common law that said, for the first time in business history in the Western world, bets on interest rates outside of the watchful gaze of an exchange are legally enforceable. Well, what would a 19th century judge predict would happen? You would predict an enormous increase in the size of the market. If we legalized murder for hire, we'd see an increase in the size of that market too, and that's what happened. Interest rate derivatives went from something that was measured in the mere trillions in terms of notional value to 67 trillion, I think it was, by the time you get to the late 1990s. The other thing that happened was the creation of this market added risk to the system, which we saw with the collapse of Orange County, Barings Bank, and the losses to Procter & Gamble, and eventually the near collapse of long-term capital management. Congress being what it is, and there's equal opportunities for blame here on both sides of the political aisle, decided that this little experiment had gone so well that they should legalize and make enforceable derivative contracts, not only in interest rate swaps, but all other financial phenomena as well. So in 2000, we get Congress passing a statute called the Commodities Futures Modernization Act. Has anyone here heard of the Commodities Futures Modernization Act? Yay! This is enormous progress. Tell everyone you know, right? Because what the CFMA again did was say that for the first time in business history, all speculative derivatives trading in financial phenomena is now legal and legally enforceable. And we see the same pattern again. Now the derivatives market leaps from $67 trillion to $600 trillion. To put that in human terms, that's about $100,000 in derivatives contracts for every human being on the planet, man, woman, child, teen, infant. And it appears that the creation of this enormous market eventually did exactly what the legalization of interest rate swaps did. It added risk to the system so that we see the collapse of Enron in 2001. By the way, Enron didn't collapse because of fraud. The fraud was to cover up the fact that they were insolvent due to bad energy derivatives bets. Then we get Bear, Lehman, and especially AIG in 2008. And that was, in this narrative, the proximate cause of the crisis of 2008. Now, that is not to say that we don't have other problems. Global warming is a problem. The obesity, rising obesity rates are a problem. But I think there's a very good story that can be told, and no evidence that I've seen yet has falsified it, that the primary trigger for 2008 was this change in the rules of the road from an Adam Smith form of capitalism, where the state only rewards productive exchange, to a new financialized version of capitalism where the state subsidized essentially zero-sum exchange and put the force of the state behind the contracts. And if that is the correct story, then certainly, from my perspective, what we need to do is we need to change the laws in some fashion that will prevent a recurrence of this sort of speculation leading to increased risk, leading to widespread institutional failures. If anyone wants to ask me about Dodd-Frank, don't everyone jump up at once. I'll explain to you how it does and does not solve this problem, but the bottom line is, stay tuned. Capitalism has not reformed itself and gone back to Adam Smith's version yet. Thank you.